Press Conference, USA. From Washington, the Voice of America brings you Press Conference, USA, an unrehearsed discussion program. Each week at this time, Washington correspondents question an outstanding personality in the news. Our guest today is the Deputy Administrator of NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, and we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff at 24 minutes after the hour.
20 seconds to go. Pictures look good. Each picture jumps you closer to the surface. We've impacted.
Here is William McCrory, the moderator of Press Conference USA.
The sounds you heard were from two highly successful American space flights this past week. The first two-man Gemini flight and the successful landing on the moon of the Ranger 9 spacecraft with television cameras aboard. People in this country and in many parts of the world heard and watched on radio and television these two flights. Our guest today plays a highly important role in such flights and in the entire American space effort. He is Dr. Hugh Dryden, Deputy Administrator of NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Dr. Dryden is an internationally known space scientist who has been honored many times for his leadership in aeronautics and astronautics. He is a pioneer in this new field of space science. In 1949, he became director of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the forerunner of NASA. Then, in 1958, with the creation of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, he became its first deputy administrator. Besides his NASA post, Dr. Dryden is the member of numerous national and international scientific committees. He is technical advisor to the U.S. representative on the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. Dr. Dryden, welcome to Press Conference USA.
I'm very happy to be with you to discuss the events of the past few days, which are very exciting even to those of us in the business.
And now I'll ask our news correspondents to identify themselves.
My name is James McCartney of the Washington Bureau of the Chicago Daily News.
James M. Minifee, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Nicholas Herbert of the Times of London.
And now for the first question to Dr. Dryden, we'll call upon you, Mr. McCartney.
Dr. Dryden, we've had an exciting week, as you know, but to me, one of the most exciting things was something I've just heard in the last few hours, and that was that there are plans in the next Gemini space flight for an American astronaut to step out into space, or at least that it might be done. Could you discuss that a little bit, just what the status of these plans are?
Yes, I think it will not be done on the next flight, as you suggest, and it may be preceded on some flight by opening the hatch and leaning out the door. Our program, of course, is aimed to develop many capabilities of which are needed for the exploration of space, and certainly the working outside of the spacecraft is one that is in our program to develop.
Let me ask one quick follow-up question to that. Do we have the technical capability today or are we within a reasonable range of the technical capability to perform the same kind of thing that the Russians have performed within the last
We are within a reasonable distance of it. I hesitate, as I have indicated, to specify the exact hour or day when we will do this, but the equipment is well along that is needed to do this.
Mr. Menefee.
I'm very interested, Dr. Dryden, in the Rangers' exploit in hitting the moon in the crater Alphonsus, and I'd like to know what you expect to do after Ranger. What comes after Ranger?
The next program after Ranger we call Surveyor. As you know, a Ranger really can give us information only about the roughness of the surface of the moon. We can make accurate contour maps, but we cannot tell the material or the bearing strength. Now, in Surveyor, we will actually land a spacecraft and its equipment, as we say, softly, something like landing on a parachute on Earth, on the surface of the moon. We will then be able to get pictures of the landscape continuously for some time thereafter, including close-ups, but more importantly, we will begin to determine the composition and nature of the surface, including its bearing strength.
What is the approximate date for a Surveyor to go into?
The first engineering flight of the vehicle will come late this year.
Mr. Herbert.
Dr. Dryden, we've talked about both the two very successful flights, and I think many of us have wondered this week whether the old axiom here that the United States is still well behind the Soviet Union in space is not now a little bit out of date. What do you think
about
that?
Yes, the situation is not a very simple one. In manned spaceflight, we still have not flown as heavy a vehicle or for as long or had as many man hours in space as the Russians. Both nations are developing the same types of capabilities to meet up with another spacecraft, to refuel or use the fuel of the new spacecraft, to dock, as we call it, to get outside and make repairs on another spacecraft or on your own. All of these abilities we need, many of them to go to the moon, but more generally, and we're both doing it. What we happen to do on a particular flight is dependent just on the details of our program. In the other fields, we believe that we have done many things which have not so far been demonstrated. For example, we put the first satellite in synchronous orbit, SYNCOM, which is now being used for communications. So our Soviet friends will not be able to put the first satellite in a synchronous orbit, for example. We've developed the first communication satellites. We've developed the first weather satellites. As far as the scientific program is concerned, we think we have obtained and published more information than our Soviet friends.
Well, go ahead, Mr. Herbert.
Just a quick follow-up question there. You mentioned weather satellites,
yes.
And I believe there's a cooperative program with the Soviet Union, which has been, from the American point of view, somewhat disappointing. Could you tell us whether you plan to continue that program?
The interpretation placed by the press on the current status is not entirely accurate. In 1962, the Soviet Union signed with us an agreement for cooperation in weather satellites and said that they would have such satellites available in the 64-65 time period. 65 is not yet over. All that I said a few minutes ago, that so far they have not demonstrated weather satellites. The agreement stands. We've set up a communications link. We are exchanging conventional data over that link. But the agreement provides that we will not send our satellite data until they send satellite data in return.
Dr. Dryden, coming back to this two-man Gemini flight of this past week, wasn't this the first time that any country has been able to maneuver from one orbit to another in a manned space flight?
Well, if you read the morning papers, there seems to be a slight controversy. It's a case where you have to listen to every word. We have manipulated many unmanned spacecraft. The maneuverability required to get SYNCOM in a synchronous orbit is quite something. The last Tyro satellite was put in a polar orbit from Canaveral by firing down the coast, changing course across Panama while it was climbing, then changing into a polar orbit on the other side of South America. So in unmanned satellites, this is an old story. And the Soviets have also done this in some of their unmanned satellites. We believe it is the first time that a manned vehicle has changed its orbit in this manner.
Mr. McCartney.
Well, I would think that activities in the last week for both the Soviets and ourselves have educated both sides on their own capabilities. Mm-hmm. We know more now than we did a week ago. Now, with all of this new information at hand, who do you think will get to the moon first?
Well, I repeat a statement I made in 1961, that we would not be surprised if the Soviet Union were not able to demonstrate rendezvous and docking before we did. That we would not be surprised, they might possibly do a mission around the moon and return to Earth. But we believed at that time, and still believe, that there's a reasonable chance that we will be the first to land men on the moon.
Mr. Menapi.
Could you give us some interpretation of the pictures that we saw sent back by Ranger? The vast number of craters that are observable there, and the rills. What's the current interpretation of those?
I will just remind you that every scientist who has looked at the pictures taken by Ranger sees in them the confirmation of his own theories. And since I don't have any theories, I hesitate to add. However, many of the craters are certainly the results of meteorites striking the moon. Since there is no atmosphere, they all hit the surface, and this has been going on over a billion years. So many of them are this type. Others are secondary effects of where a large meteorite strikes and scatters debris to make other craters of smaller debris. Now, many scientists think that some of the craters are of volcanic origin, and you'll see many debates of this sort. The rills have given rise to a great deal of speculation. They are so straight that if we didn't know different, we might accuse them of being the construction of man. They're long and straight. In fact, they were called freeways, remember, by the first scientists who looked at them. They seem to be the result of a settling of the surface. This is one theory, as a result of an underground flow, not of water, but perhaps of lava. Another theory is that it's a crack in the moon's surface, a fault which has been filled up with debris and looks as it does. I think we need a lot more information, as I've indicated before we can tell very much about the character of the surface itself.
Yes, well, you mentioned that some of the smaller craters were obviously the result of meteoric impact, and since there's no atmosphere, they all hit. Is there any real serious risk to a moon capsule or to men on the moon from the impacting meteors?
It is nothing like the risk of driving an automobile on the streets of this city or of being hit by a meteorite out in the country. You have to remember that all the craters that you see on the moon have collected there over a period of something of the order of 2 billion years. So the number which hit in any one year are pretty small, and most meteorites, as we've learned, are very tiny. In fact, we assess the risk in space now considerably less than we did before we made any measurements.
Mr. Herbert.
Dr. Dryden, one of the more exciting things that we haven't yet talked about is the Mariner spacecraft, which is, I believe, just over halfway to Mars. Yes. Could you tell us a little about what you expect of that?
Yes, the Mariner mission, if successful, will bring back about 21 TV pictures of Mars. They will not be of the same quality that you saw in Ranger. This comes about from many limitations which I don't need to describe in detail. One interesting fact is that it will take us a whole day to transmit back one picture, so we will not be able to show you passage of Mars in real time.
And are there plans for photographic and other sorts of missions to others of the planets, Venus?
Only in the sense of thinking about the distant future. There are no concrete funded or definitely authorized programs.
We'll have more questions for Dr. Dryden in just a few moments. But first, a reminder that you're listening to Press Conference USA, broadcast by the Voice of America from Washington. Our guest this week is Dr. Hugh Dryden, Deputy Administrator of NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The news correspondents asking the questions are James M. Menefee of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, Nicholas Herbert of the Times of London, and James McCartney of the Chicago Daily News. Now more questions for Dr. Dryden. We'll call upon you, Mr. McCartney.
There's one aspect of the American space program, Dr. Dryden, that we haven't been hearing much about in the last few days. That is the question arises out of a recent poll, a national poll, which showed that many Americans, can't remember what the percentage was, still wonder whether the expense of the manned spaceflight program and the expense of going to the moon is worth it. How do you answer questions about that?
Yes, a complete exposition would take a very long time, but let me try to put it very simply. We live in a very large country here in the United States with a great deal of resources. Just in round numbers, we have or will soon have 200 million people. We are spending on the NASA space program about $5 billion. That is $25 per year per capita. My favorite response is that if we reduce the consumption of cocktails by one per week, we are able to pay for the space program. Or you can make many other comparisons of this kind which show that the $5 billion is not a major fraction of the resources of this country. And we do not believe that its existence is depriving us of doing the other things that we ought to do as well.
Mr. Menefee?
To go back to Mariner 4, when it gets to Mars, what is the program? Is it going around it? Will it be occulted by Mars? Will it be able to pick up any details about the atmosphere? Just what is it supposed to do, Dr. Dryden?
I cannot tell you all of the experiments. The principal one is the 21 pictures as it passes at a distance of something of the order, I believe, of 4,500 miles. It will be deflected by the gravitational field of Mars and pass behind it. And we hope that the reception of the radio signals from it will give us some small information about whether there is an ionosphere, for example, or some little information about the atmosphere of Mars.
Is there anything positive known about whether there is, say, water vapor or moisture of any sort on Mars?
It's a matter of controversy. Some spectroscopists claim to have seen water bands.
Mr. Herbert.
Dr. Dryden, I'd like to go back to Gemini and rendezvous in space for a moment. What is the principal difficulty now as far as rendezvous goes? We've seen that the Gemini has been able to maneuver itself, and we've seen from the Russians that a man can operate in space. Does this seem to leave the way clear to joining up
two vehicles? There is no difficulty. It's very hard for the average person to understand the time problem involved. We have been building this equipment over a period of the last 3 years, approximately. The Gemini that will be used in rendezvous is nearly finished in the plant of the manufacturer. The Gina vehicle with which it will rendezvous is substantially finished and will be undergoing ground tests very shortly at the plant of the manufacturer. We have a program which will investigate many ways of getting the information needed in rendezvous, radar, optical, all the rest of it, automatic or under the control of the pilot, so that it's all geared up to go. The Ranger flight that you saw today is a result of a decision made 3-4 years ago. And the rendezvous that you will see is a result of a decision made some years ago.
Oh, go ahead, Mr. Herbert.
And related to that, you spoke some time ago of the possibility that the Russians would send a man round the moon. Is there anything to be said for that scientifically, or would that be regarded as simply
done in our program depending on how much confidence we have as to whether we are prepared to set the man down on the surface of the moon. As a matter of fact, our missions are so planned that we can go into orbit around the moon, as you know. If there's any malfunction or reason to worry, then they'll come home from that orbit. If it looks all right, the LEM will go down to the surface. If, as he approaches the surface, he sees something that's completely unexpected and worries him, he can go back up and join the ship and come home. So that I think it is merely one possible mission that might be done along the way if it seems desirable to do it.
Mr. McCartney.
One of the things I think all of us are concerned about when we watch some of these spectaculars that you're staging is how it is that we've gotten along this far without anybody getting killed. Do you think we've been lucky?
There is a certain amount of luck. We cannot deny the risk. I do assure you that we've taken every step that we know how to protect the lives of the men. I think many of you perhaps know that every one of these missions is rehearsed with the men sitting in the actual capsule, connected up to the tracking stations around the world, and they run simulated missions, which they say are more severe than the actual missions because they put in emergencies for them to cope with, so as to train them. Now, the only thing missing is a little tension, if you call it that, of the man being actually in space. I would, however, like to say that the tension of the man who flies the X-15 airplane and drops off and lands in 10 or 15 minutes is higher than that of the pilots riding around the Earth. His heartbeat goes higher.
Mr. Minovic.
Is there any indication that the Russians have lost people in space?
None whatever, to my knowledge.
Mr. Herbert.
Dr. Dryden, the X-15 raises in my mind a question which I'm not sure is relevant, but I'll ask it all the same. Do you believe that a supersonic commercial aircraft is a feasible thing at this time?
Well, NASA staked its reputation on saying that they think it is feasible.
Yeah. Dr. Dryden, they've called this first of the Gemini flights almost flawless. Were you people at NASA well satisfied, completely satisfied with the results?
Very
you think
well.
Anything could have been better? Or?
Very well satisfied. You never have complete perfection. As you know, there was a tendency to for the vehicle to turn at a rate, I believe, of a quarter of a degree per second, whose, in spite of the newspaper report, the exact cause has not yet been run down because we haven't analyzed all the telemetry. It was not a rate of motion sufficient to cause any trouble. There are one or two bits of equipment which didn't function exactly. They had to go to backup in one case, but these are common incidents of the flights of new devices and even of old ones. Airplanes still have this problem.
The capsule did come down a little unexpectedly, did it not? A bit off target. Is there any known reason for that yet?
Well, as of this moment, we cannot give you a complete analysis of this. We, again, have to wait until all of the records have been analyzed. There are two elements. One, whether, in fact, the attitude of the capsule on retrofire was the intended attitude. Second, since during the reentry the pilot used a program of using the lift of the capsule to vary the path, whether this program took place as planned, and say I cannot tell you exactly what happened at the moment.
I don't understand the term the lift of the capsule.
The capsule's center of gravity is not on the axis, so it is possible to cock it at an angle and to get a lift. And by rotating the capsule, this can be pointed in any direction. So that the Gemini capsule is able to steer some, I believe it's 25 miles to either side, perhaps 50 miles long or 50 miles short.
That would be when it's re-entered the atmosphere.
In the actual re-entry. And you understand how difficult it is to track and compute from data that you get just before it lands.
Mr. Herbert?
Dr. Dryden, I believe the Russian flight last a week ago had a similar landing problem. Can you tell us anything about what you've learned about that?
I can tell you what the Russians themselves have said. There was a failure of the, I don't know whether they've used that word, they don't like that word, but the automatic system didn't function on the intended orbit, and they went an extra orbit and entered manually. And as the astronauts said at their press conference, they landed in a forested area of deep snow and wolf country, and hunters were the first to reach them.
Mr. Herbert?
And how soon will the first American astronaut land on land, and is there any great advantage in
We do not have such large waste areas and have not wanted to attempt it at all until we had some maneuverability. water impact is a much more predictable phenomena than impact on land. You might hit a railroad track, a rock, or a plowed field, or water within the middle of the country. So we have been conservative and gotten a situation where we can make the engineering tests and computations, and every landing is predictable.
Mr. McCartney.
In the Russian flight where the man stepped out into space, one of the astonishing achievements there, to me at least, was that they were able to televise it. When are we going to be able to put our own manned flights on television?
Now, I'm going to be quite frank and perhaps insult some of you. The information obtained from onboard television is very limited as far as we're concerned in measuring the performance of men and equipment. And we can do it at any time, but we don't propose to. We're going to use the weight for equipment which makes measurements of greater interest. Oh. We will have pictures. They will come back, better pictures coming back from cameras on board. When our man gets out, the other astronaut will take his picture with the camera, and you will see them, but we're not going to attempt to put a television camera on broadcast at real time.
Are you suggesting, Dr. Dryden, that was a publicity stunt on the part of the Russians?
I made no suggestion.
Mr. Medovey.
Will pictures be, televised pictures be flashed back from the surveyor when it gets down to the surface of the moon?
I believe that can be done in real time because we do have the communications capability to handle it. We don't at the distance of Mars.
By real time, you mean what?
Well, within a few seconds. As actually happened in this last Ranger flight. We have a different number of lines in commercial TV. On the same signal, we have about four pictures from four cameras. You have to get apparatus which decodes this, and synchronizes with one picture, changes the number of lines, and that takes a matter of a couple of seconds.
I think we have time for one brief question, Mr. Herbert.
Dr. Dryden, how soon do you think the first man will actually land on the moon?
We answer the question this way. We have scheduled 15 flights of the Saturn V vehicle with the Apollo on it. What we are unwilling to predict at this time is just on which flight we will have established the confidence to do this. Up until the last few years, all 15 have been scheduled before the end of 1969. As a result of the actions taken with regard to the level of funding, three or four of these flights now extend over into 1970. The schedule has very little reserve for explosions, accidents, delays.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry our time has run out. My thanks to Dr. Dryden and to our panel of news correspondents. You have been listening to Press Conference USA, a weekly discussion program broadcast by The Voice of America. Our guest today was Dr. Hugh Dryden, Deputy Administrator of NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The news correspondents were Nicholas Herbert of the Times of London, James Minifee of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and James McCartney of the Chicago Daily News. Your moderator was William McCrory. Join us again next week at this time for another unrehearsed discussion on Press Conference USA.